So I wanted to talk a little bit about my experience in New Zealand. When I came here, I was about 28. And I wanted to experience living in the wilderness. And I'd been living at Greenham Common Peace Camp. Has anybody heard of that? Yeah. Anybody? Oh, wow. That's so great. So for those of you who are not familiar, Greenham was a women's peace camp protesting nuclear arms. And I was living there, and we were doing non-violent direct action and having a very exciting time. And after a while, I realized that I was tired of saying no to something, and that I wanted to see what would happen investigating the yes instead of the no. And one of the reasons I think that happened is because we were being evicted every 3 or 4 days, and so we had to take our tents down and put everything into shopping carts and take them down the road and then bring them all back again and set up the whole camp again. And there was just this feeling of like, what if we could actually build structures that would last? And what if we used our energy for what we really wanted to build? And so I got interested in women's communities. And one of the great things about Greenham was that sometimes tens of thousands of women would come and do an action, and they were coming from all over the world. So you were hearing about things going on in faraway places. And I heard about this little community on the Coromandel, and which some of you, do you know about it? Is anybody? It's called Aradia. I don't think it's going anymore. I looked it up before I came to see if it was still going, but it was this little tiny women's community on the Coromandel, and I thought, I want to go there, and maybe we can build something and see what might happen. You know, that whole idea of living simply and sustainably and close to the land and in deep connection with nature and also outside of mainstream culture was really important to me at that time. I thought the mainstream culture was way too consumer-oriented and competitive and individualistic, and I wanted to see what we could create outside of those paradigms. So, I came to the Coromandel, and I stayed there for a few months. And then I went down to the south of the North Island, and I met up with some women in Wellington, and one of them was a PE teacher. Do you say PE? Yeah. And she was quite sporty, and she convinced me to go for a sea kayaking adventure, which was really fun. And then she had to go back to work, but she said that she thought I should do this bike trip. And I've never done anything very athletic in my life, and I wasn't very sure about it, but I borrowed a bike and some panniers for my camping gear, and I set off on the ferry for the South Island. And, yeah, I had no idea what I was about to experience. And I think I can say it was the happiest time that I'd experienced in my life up till then. And as I look back on it, I realize that that trip bears quite a lot of resemblance to a meditation retreat. I don't know how many of you have been on retreats. Is that quite a lot of you? Yeah. So I was reflecting on that parallel and the elements of the cycling trip and the way it really was a bit like a deep dive into a solo meditation experience. And I hadn't ever got that quiet, gone day after day after day being silent. And I think I was about a week in, and I realized that this kind of quiet contentment and connection with myself and the surroundings was really quite deep. And I called up the person who had loaned me the panniers and the bike, and I said, can I have these for a little bit longer? And she said, oh yeah, take as long as you want. And so I ended up cycling for 6 weeks. And I think I still carry that feeling about silence not being an absence of something, but actually being a potential for hearing something else that I don't have access to when my mind is full of its usual chatter. I just found all sorts of things floating up, really surprising things from the adverts on TV when I was a kid, jingles, you know, little things, the hymns that I had sung in church, things I hadn't thought about for one split second in years and years and years were suddenly just floating up. And I found myself just listening to both internally and externally to what was arising in a much more intimate way than I had ever done. And I remember watching birds, and their song felt like it was in my throat. It was so close. And I'd never known that before, and I could feel almost like the claw of the bird on the branch. It was just like it was not so separate from my body. And I found that just so joyous and joyful. I felt more awake than I'd ever felt. And then, of course, I think part of kind of this deeper listening and spaciousness, just making space, I found that both regrets and gratitude were coming quite strongly to the fore. And sort of unresolved, unacknowledged pieces of my life were coming up, and I would just be with them, and memories and regrets and things I hadn't thought of as all that important were suddenly taking on a different size and a different significance. And I started writing quite a lot of letters. I wrote to the mother of my best friend when I was a kid, and she had just I guess. I mean, I never thought about it, but she must have just seen what a troubled kid I was. And she offered me a little spot, my own spot in her house under the stairs. And she said I could come anytime, day or night. And that was my place. And I had my little Zed bed. I don't know if you could have a Zed like that, one of those beds that you kind of pull out. And I just was, I mean, I'd always known that Sally's mum had sort of saved me, but I didn't quite feel it to the fullness that I did during that trip. That she just would listen to me. I would go over to Sally's house and spend an hour or so in the kitchen with her mum before I'd even go up and see my friend Sally. And I mean, I was 10. What was I talking about to this woman? I mean, she must have just been so patient and loving, and well, she was so patient and loving, and it felt so natural. I didn't feel like she was an adult and I was a kid, and it was just this really significant relationship for me. And yeah, pretty amazing to feel that deep regard and respect, you know, between, I was 10, 11 years old, up until I was 18. But yeah, I realized I'd never fully thanked her or acknowledged what a difference she'd made. And I wrote other letters expressing gratitude and regret for things, times when I wasn't a good friend or that I'd glossed over things that were that did matter. And I sort of felt like I had this capacity to feel in a whole new way. And it was interesting because I heard this, I wish I could tell you who said it, but somebody said, we don't meditate to feel better. We meditate to feel better, to get better at feeling. And I really liked that. And I felt like that was a part of what was going on for me in this silent bike trip. I was learning how to feel better, you know, more fully, more accurately, more sensitively. Yeah. And then later when I started doing meditation retreats, I realized that it's quite a common theme that many of us experience, where we have to be with those places where we weren't able to live according to our values, where we did regrettable things, and we have to grieve and, you know, touch into those places and really allow and feel the regret. And I remember on my first ever retreat hearing the phrase, the joy of no remorse. And I was like, oh, yeah, yeah. I recognized it from that whole experience of just having to feel the remorse that I did. Let me just see what the time is. Yeah. So the other thing that was really apparent in New Zealand was the kindness and the giving. I felt really held and safe. And I think that's because I just was repeatedly encountering incredible kindness. I don't think I ever encountered any unkindness in all the time I was here. And I was so naive about cycling. I had no clue how to fix a bike. I didn't even know how to mend a puncture. So I was on the receiving end of quite a lot of kindness from total strangers. My brakes stopped working. I had a couple of blowouts. I broke some spokes because I was carrying too much weight in the panniers for the kind of bike it was. And I just was helped a lot and supported a lot. I remember cycling along this little back road, and I was cycling this way, and this elderly couple in a car were coming towards me, and they pulled over and they said, you're cycling on our road. And I said, we have a brown house just like a mile down the way on the right-hand side. Go on in and make yourself at home and have a bath and we'll be back in an hour. We're just going to go and get some pine cones in the forest. And and it was just so lovely. Like, there was nothing I wanted more than a bath. And to have them kind of intuit that with so much kindness and trust. And I was just so moved by that. I never forgot it. So, and the other thing that I remember is there was a couple of times when I would cycle into a campsite and other cyclists would spot my bike and they would come over and want to compare notes. And they would ask me things like, well, how many miles did you do today? And I realized that, oh dear, you know, it wasn't very acceptable in their eyes that I had only done 10 miles because I found a dry riverbed and I hid my bike under a bridge and walked down the riverbed for most of the day. And I remember one time, I think I must have been down near Dunedin and it was really hilly and I was getting tired and a bit fed up of the hills. And so I hitched a ride and somebody in a ute stopped. I learnt the term ute. Stopped and put my bike in the back and gave me a ride. And then that night at the campsite, somebody asked me where I had started from that morning. And I sort of tried to explain. And they had this horrified look and they said, that would ruin my whole trip if I took a ride. And I remember just feeling like, oh, this isn't being so fun talking to the other cyclists. And because the other thing that they would do endlessly was laugh at my bike because it was not a touring bike. It was a $30 ridiculous bicycle. And you know, sort of your average everyday bicycle. I don't mean to say ridiculous because it totally got me all the way around the South Island. But it wasn't your average bike that everyone else was riding. And so it was a bit of a... it would attract comments that I didn't really want to hear. And I remember sometimes I would go into a campsite and cover my bike with pine needles because I didn't want to be sort of identifiable as a cyclist. I just wanted to be able to rest quietly and then get up and go in the morning. But I was thinking about the topic that Jill and I are going to be teaching on next week, which is how we hold our views and opinions and just in case I was going to formulate the view that other cyclists are not fun, I then met this cyclist who I really liked and ended up cycling with him for a few days and actually sharing food. And I remember he was growing bean sprouts on the back of his bike. He was sprouting lentils and things. I was like really impressed. But yeah, it's so easy to formulate a theory and stick to it, you know. And it was really great to actually have this experience with someone who I really enjoyed cycling with. Yeah. And let's just see how the time's going here. I was getting up really early. I was not only not an athlete, I was a little bit of a slug abed before this experience. And I had never really woken up early on any ongoing basis and seen the dawn. And I got really into getting up before the dawn, watching the whole dawn, packing up my tent and getting on the road. And Yeah, that brings me to a whole nother thing, which was finding dead animals on the road, because I was the first on the road. And one morning I found a white owl on the road. And what I would do is pick these animals up and put them to the side, you know, find a nice place to lay them down. And this owl was just like so beautiful, and I'd never been that close to an owl, and its eyes and its beak and its feathers, and I just was this mixture of sort of horror struck and beauty struck as well. It was really an incredible experience to actually be that close to it. And and I laid it down, and then I did something that I've carried for years of like, oh, I can't believe I did that. So I think I just wanted to hold on to something of that experience, and I wanted one feather. And I went to take this feather, and it didn't give. And I knew that I was taking something that was not freely given. And I had this sickened feeling in my stomach. It just really pierced me, this sort of, basically the greed of wanting something from this animal. And then it was really wild, because a few days later I took another bird off the road. It wasn't a beautiful white owl. It was a largish, brownish bird. And I laid it down, and as I was laying it down, poof, it gave me two feathers, just like, and I was like, yeah, that's very different to actually receive what's freely given rather than trying to take something. So, let's see if there's anything else I wanted to say. I think what I most want to, or maybe what I want to end with, is this whole thing of not having a plan or a destination. I really didn't know where I was going. I didn't have a route. I just was cycling and seeing what it felt like and responding to what was arising. But this thing of being free of expectations, free of the attachment to getting anywhere. I don't know if anyone's familiar with the Heart Sutra in Zen. I've done quite a lot of Zen study. And you have this big bell when you're doing the chant leading, which I used to do, and chant the Heart Sutra. And there's a line in the Heart Sutra which says, since there is nothing to attain. And on that line, you boing, oing, 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 that bell right there. And you don't do it at that many lines. There's only a couple of places in the Heart Sutra you do that. So it really draws attention that there is nothing to attain. And I feel like I was learning that on this destinationless kind of trip of how, if I think I'm going somewhere, it puts a space between me and that place. And at some point I'm going to get there, and then I start thinking about being there. I'm not quite here anymore. So let's see. I think I'll mention that, because I think it's important. Just the wake-up call I had around being a white Pākehā visitor. And I think it was the first time I had left Europe, and I hadn't understood the kind of colonial experience, the colonial mentality. And I think I began to see it when I was here because I had sort of come out of the water that I was swimming in. And I was doing things that were not culturally sensitive for Maori folks. And I was staying in a house for a while with a woman, and she had a Maori roommate. And I was saying to Jill, I think I put a motorbike helmet on the table, and I didn't realize that that was really not sensitive. And I sat on a pillow, and oh, I was just doing things that were stimulating pain. And then that double layer of pain of realizing that these things are repeatedly, you know, sort of hitting into the same places over and over and over. And I guess it was just really broadening for me to become aware of my own whiteness, my own racism, my own lack of awareness, and the assumptions that we make that other people's cultures are going to be similar, and that I can come into a house and know how to be respectful. And it was really like, oh, huge for me to realize that I didn't know. And yeah, that it's all just a viewpoint in a way, cultural experience, and it's so easy to make assumptions and have that slight sense of one's own culture being the norm, you know. And I think that was quite a wake up for me, an important one that I really value. So I wanted to end with a koan, which is a teaching from the Zen tradition that comes out of Tang Dynasty China, 6th to 9th roughly century China, where the teachings were became very condensed into kind of pithy exchanges and phrases, because Buddhism was being persecuted at the time, and libraries were being burned, and monastics were being forced out into lay life. And so they were trying to preserve the teachings by making them very portable. So that's the kind of circumstances that the koans originated from. And so this is a koan. Often koans are short exchanges between students and teachers, sometimes between peers. But in this koan, the teacher says, "Where are you going?" And the student, Fayan, says, "Around on pilgrimage." And Dijang says, "What's the purpose of pilgrimage?" And the student, Fayan, said, "I don't know." And the teacher said, "Not knowing is most intimate. Not knowing is most intimate." And just to say that in the Chinese Zen, the word intimate is synonymous with awake and awakening. So not knowing is most awake or intimate. And yeah, let's take a little break on that note, and then we can have some tea and maybe see what we might want to reflect on or ask about or inquire together afterwards. So, yeah, thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much. So, you'll see that we can try to keep our voices a little bit after that beautiful talk, so you can continue with some of that intellect and awake energy. And of course, we can connect with each other as well as tonight. So, just do your best to softly if you can. Okay, well, I'll ring a bell in about 15 minutes. Thank you. And that's Donna Horse too.
It was quite uncomfortable,
yeah.
It was, and I was thinking it's because my head is so big. Because I do have an unusually large head, so I was thinking that's why it's tight. Because most people's heads are smaller. Thank you. It's freeing me.
Yeah.
Oh no, you keep that one.